And first of all, welcome all. It's a tremendous chus to be able to speak before Pesach to people who are putting an immense effort, most likely, in preparing for Pesach. In reality, today I'll probably discuss many things that seem like leniencies to many people. But before doing so, I'm going to encourage not being lenient. And that's not for halachic purpose. Everything we do down here has a tremendous impact up above. There's every act that we do, we build worlds. Every mitzvah that we do, we build worlds. And chalila, if somebody does, God forbid, somebody does an aveira, does a sin, they can be destroying things in the upper worlds. So if that's true, it is true, but that being the case, minute details, it's kind of like, you think about it, any of you renovated or built a house or something like that, minute details become very, very important when you're building things. The difference between a gorgeous house and just a house that's just barely livable is very often just the details. A house that's going to last long term, as opposed to something which is going to need to be re-renovated in just a few years, is very often those minor details. So the way we do the mitzvos, those minor details in the mitzvos have an immense impact on what we're building. So the way we approach the mitzvos and the attention we give to all aspects of the mitzvos is therefore items of tremendous impact. So, just because you hear a leniency today doesn't mean that you have to throw out whatever you've been doing till now. You don't have to accept the leniency. And if you hear something that sounds like, maybe a little bit more stringent than you usually do, maybe take it on in stride. And bichlal, we should appreciate what we're doing because we're building our future lives. And Chazal tell us, the Gemara in Tainus says, it brings a pasuk from the Navi, that loy avay ad she avay. And the Gemara explains, it expounds on the pasuk, loy avay ad she avay, loy avay b'Yerushalayim shalmalo, ad she avay b'Yerushalayim shalmato. I won't come in the heavenly Yerushalayim until I come in the Yerushalayim below. Rashi on the spot explains that what does that mean? Until Yerushalayim Shalmato becomes filled with Kedusha, Yerushalayim Shalmala won't be rebuilt. Until we fill Yerushalayim with Torah and Mitzvos, the Yerushalayim of above won't be built. But as we're filling that, we're taking an active role in building Yerushalayim Shalmala. Being here in Yerushalayim, learning about the mitzvos, learning Torah, and then actually acting them, taking them into the active stage of doing the mitzvos, cleaning for Pesach, preparing for Pesach, etc. We're taking an active role in building Yerushalayim Shalmalo and in bringing the Geula Asido. So, when it comes to Pesach cleaning, there's all sorts of, everybody has all their jokes about Pesach cleaning, and some people don't think the jokes are jokes. They think they're very serious, and they'll be insulted if you refer to them as jokes. But we clean all sorts of surfaces. We kosherize all sorts of surfaces. We're going to focus now more on the things that are the common questions that come up in terms of koshering one's kitchen, preparing one's kitchen for Pesach. We'll try to talk a little bit about questions that have to do with Pesach products on the market here in Israel in particular, and some tips and guides for kind of understanding some of the code words as they're constantly creating newer code words to confuse people even more about their Pesach shopping. So we'll decodify them also. In terms of kashering, I think some of the frequent questions that come up, especially in Israel, and increasingly so in America also, where the Formica countertops are kind of passé, and people have moved on to either proper marble counters or granite counters, or to what they call a Caesar stone. So stone can be kashered. Things which are properly stone, no questions about it, they can be kashered. You purge them with hot water, you take boiling hot water. Now there's a debate about how hot the water needs to be. The debate isn't really a halachic debate. It's a debate of how one uses a counter. Because most of the time, people aren't using their counter directly for hot things, rather putting down a hot pot. It reasons that it's sufficient to pour boiling water from what we refer to as a kli rishon, something which the water was boiled on or in. Really, the best way to accomplish this nowadays is you have an urn, a Shabbos urn, boil the water in the Shabbos urn, wait till it comes to a complete boil, leave the boiling mode on, wait till it comes to a complete boiling, and then you can unplug it and just scoot it over the counter with the spout open. Okay, and then it doesn't all have to be done. If you have a tremendously large counter, it doesn't all have to be done in one shot. You can do it piece by piece. Ideally, after you pour hot water on it, so one should pour also cold water over it afterwards, and that's so that that it cools down right away and we don't have any other questions, etc. So lechatchila, the ideal way of doing it is to pour cold water afterwards, so it gives you a lot of water on the floor to do sponger with afterwards, and you end up with a clean floor also at some point in time.
Waiting.
So before you, things that were used for hot, you can't use it for hot for 24 hours. Doesn't mean you can't use it. Counters generally aren't used for hot. You might put down on it a hot pot. So you shouldn't put down a hot pot, especially if it might be a little bit dirty, for 24 hours. However, even if somebody did, they would be able to kosherize the counter afterwards. It wouldn't be like a pot that you actually used, because only a minor part of the counter, unless you put down some huge tray or something like that that had a lot of food stuck to the bottom of it, I don't know, something exploded in your oven, the whole tray was pouring, and you put it down on the counter, it was a big tray, and half your counter got covered with some hot substance or something like that. But if it's just a little part of your counter that got a little bit of something hot on it, it shouldn't really render it a problem. Where the 24 hours is going to be more important is when we talk about things like utensils in the kitchen, and sinks. Sinks are very important. I'm going to explain that. Sinks. Okay, and I'm going to explain that in a second.
How do you move the water off the counter? Is it okay just to use a regular...
So you should, ideally you should buy a new squeegee or whatever they call them, those items.
It wasn't clear when you said that you take an urn, you put it in one shot?
No. You open the spout. You open the spout of the urn, okay, and then you just, then you move the urn slowly over the counter so that the whole counter gets covered with boiling hot water. Okay, now, in an instance, for whatever reason, let's say somebody does have, you know, they cook more industrially, and they have maybe even a stainless steel countertop or something like that, and they're constantly putting down very, very hot items on the counter, and they're boiling things in countertop burners and all sorts of things, and they think that it gets to cooking temperatures, their counter. So then, ideally, it should be kashered with currently boiling water. Until recently, the way this was accomplished was by taking a stone, making the stone red hot, pouring hot water from a utensil that the water was boiled in, almost instantly after it was boiled, and pouring it over that stone so it doesn't lose heat, but it, if anything, gets even hotter from the stone. It was complicated. You had to hold it with, you know, some sort of tongs and be extremely careful, etc. Nowadays, again, if you would be able to take an urn that's plugged in, again, nobody's going to tell you it's safe, and I'm not recommending it, but if this was the situation, somebody would take an urn that was plugged in, that would be perfect. They wouldn't have to do anything. It's still at boiling point, and they just move it along their counter. That would work just fine, be perfect, and it certainly would be as safe as it might not be. It's certainly more safe than handling this burning hot stone with tongs and not being sure then anymore if it's burning and dropping it and breaking your floor and breaking your toes and feet and whatever else. It's certainly more safe than that. So that would be the method of kashering it, which might also be a preferred method just for the sink. But since the sink is a more minor area and the water is going down into the sink, it's a little easier. And the reason for that, let's first just discuss what types of sinks you can kasher. Porcelain sinks, which some people like either because it's, you know, they're in style, it's retro or whatever it is, or maybe because they live in an older house, and in Israel until not that many years ago, those were the common sinks. So that can't be kashered, and then the only thing you can do is you go into one of the hardware stores here in Israel. The best thing to do is to buy one of these inserts for the right size of your sink, and it goes in, and after Pesach, it's kind of gross underneath it, but then you can use bleach to clean it, and you don't have to kosherize it. Alternatively, people put racks or different things in the bottom of their sink so it shouldn't touch it, or just a basin on the side of the sink, and they're careful that things don't touch it. And truth be known, this is one of the leniencies. If you don't leave it there for long term, meaning you put something down in the sink, it's not burning hot anymore. Now that you took your pot straight off the stove and you put it into your ceramic sink. Your sink was cleaned well before Pesach. And now you take something, it was a plate that you just ate a meal on. It's not burning hot. You put it down in the sink. As long as it doesn't stay there for 24 hours, it's totally fine. Nothing happened to your plate, nothing happened to your sink. Is that the ideal way of doing it? No. On Pesach, we're extra stringent, and yeah, a person should put down minimally a rack or an insert or something like that. Additionally, if somebody would take their pot, which they just made soup in, and they put it directly in there, or I hope it doesn't happen to anybody here, but they burn a dish, and they dump it into the sink super quick, and they start pouring cold water onto it, whatever it is, but now it touches it, burning hot, there's stuff in the bottom of the sink, that would be a problem in the middle of Pesach. So it's not a wise idea to leave such a setup. But if somebody has such an area which is exposed, and they happen, the spoon falls there when they're putting in, it's not the end of the world, all is fine. Even on Pesach, continue using the spoon, continue using your sink, nothing happened. Okay. Stainless steel sinks, which are nowadays probably the most common sink, that's fully kosherable. And again, the way to kosher it is with the with boiling water. Here, the reason why, if somebody is brave enough and has an urn that they can use plugged in, that it's better to use an urn, is because we say that when liquid stays somewhere for 24 hours, it has the same halachic status as if you had just boiled liquid in that spot. So, in a sink, people are apt to having things stay there in water for 24 hours at some point in time over the course of the year. Whether it's, a Friday night, they didn't eat their Shabbos day, they didn't end up washing up the dishes, and they left dishes there from Friday night, and whatever it is, it took some time, or whatever it is, they went away for a day and they left some dishes in the sink, etc. It's things that are apt to happening in sinks. Or whether the type of person, they don't wash dishes every day, they wait till they have somewhat of a buildup. It's just, a couple or whatever it is, they wait till there's a buildup or a single person, and they wait for a buildup for dishes, and dishes can be there for a full day.
But that's if you have water all covering the dishes.
Yeah, but often there'll be water between the pot and the sink that stay there, as if you pick up something that was in the sink. So because it's something which is apt to happening, I think it's prudent to, again, I don't think it's Me'ikar HaDin. I think if somebody can kosher it with regular boiling water, that would also work. Okay? And so that's for kashering sinks.
You didn't say, it wasn't clear. It's the same method as
the counters, boiling water, except for that it might be a better idea if you can leave the urn plugged in while you're pouring the water out. But again, you just take the urn around the edge of the sink, let it go down the walls of the sink, and then, you can, afterwards, you can open it up, or you can do whatever it is and unplug it then for the last final thing, because it's just a split second, that's also fine. And pour the boiling water directly into the middle of the sink or something like that, and that's all fine and good.
You can strain each side of the sink in between.
No.
Do the whole thing,
and then pour cold water, turn on your faucet, and cold water.
Caesar stone.
So Caesar stone, the OU's position is that Caesar stone can be kashered. The reason for that is that it's not, it's like 97% stone. So the minimal amount of glue that's there, Rabbi Belsky, Zichron Levracha, maintained that it's bottle, that it's nullified to the rest of the stone that's there, and it's kasherable.
What about the tank?
So that's what I was about to talk about. It doesn't need to be, it does not need to be kashered. Okay. One thing that you certainly should not do. Okay. I'm not starting up with anybody's minhagim, but one thing that if it wasn't your minhag, do not do is put like a sack or one of these nice little white things that they sell to put over it. Okay. Because what you're probably going to do with that is create more issues than you're going to solve. The reason for that is like this. As long as something comes out as part of the water and things like that, it's all fine and good. The second I start sifting things out, it gets separated and mixed back in and things like that, that's when I get into situations of problem. So when you put something over the faucet, right, so there's all the fancy shilas about water. You'll probably see if any of you read the news or whether it's electronic news or a newspaper, Erev Pesach, they'll have a picture of the Rav Rashi or something like that going to shut off the water supply of Israel before Pesach. The reason for that is that chametz on Pesach isn't nullified. Before Pesach, it's nullified. A minute amount of chametz that got mixed into something before Pesach, fine, right? The same way that during the year, a tiny bit of, you know, something fell into whatever it is. You know, you call up the rabbi with a shiloh about a pot. You were making soup and used the wrong spoon or whatever it is. I'll ask you, how big is the pot? How big is the spoon? I'll tell you, okay, you know, it's batel. It's batel b'shishim, all different measurements, right? It'll start. So things are batel before Pesach. On Pesach, they're not. So the issue with the water is that, you know, maybe there's going to be some guy who takes his kids to the reservoir to catch tadpoles or little fish or whatever it is, and he brings some Arab or whatever it is, but he brings little bread. He brings like a, you know, an old roll, a stale roll with him to the thing, and he puts it into the water. Now, the water is still getting pumped out of the reservoir on Pesach. So what's going to happen is that chametz that fell in to the reservoir isn't batel, and it becomes part of that water that's all there. And when it comes out in somebody's sink or something like that at some point in time, it's not batel. So what we'd like to do is make it all be batel before Pesach. We close off the water supply that it's within a contained water supply chain, that now it's not open to any to being contaminated by chametz, so to speak. And whatever chametz might have fallen in, you know, just a negligible amount, again, you know, the fishing tadpole type of scenario, is no longer going to be a problem because it was cut off before Pesach. Now, if I separate something that was maybe that tiny, 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 tiny bit of chametz that somehow made it through, or maybe it was something that was kind of like attached and just came through, it's when I start playing around with it too much, I'm asking for issues. Clean it out well, yes. If you do want to be machmir, if somebody wants to be super machmir on their faucets, gesundheit, it's fine. Buy a new faucet. Yes, because of the water that was left, because things might have been there with water, so it needs to be left 24 hours before. Cold water would be fine, and a negligible amount of cold water, you washed your hands in it, that would be fine. I wouldn't recommend washing dishes cold there beforehand, because then you might run into issues that something stayed wet for a prolonged period of time, or that when you're actually kashering it, it wasn't fully clean, etc., etc. So it's best that you shouldn't wash any dishes or anything like that. Again, it's accidentally, you know, your little kid, whether it's your child, your grandchild, you know, depending on who I'm speaking to here in the room, right, that comes in and drops their bowl of cereal into the sink. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to start counting 24 hours over again. It was cold, rinse out the sink, cold, quickly, and you don't have to wait 24 hours, okay? You could. No, to pour it on the tap, it doesn't hurt, and you might be accomplishing something. Also, you know, the handles definitely should be clean, which we're going to say the same thing about stovetop handles and oven handles. Do not cover them with aluminum foil, okay? Because once upon a time, covering them with aluminum foil worked. But now, it's such cheap quality that it's a fire hazard. Because what will happen is the plastic might start melting, and it might actually cause a fire. Right, and it is a fire hazard. You know, even when you think you have, you know, a big Maytag American, you know, beast of an oven and stovetop and whatever it is, it can still happen. If you want a proof, you can come see mine. We have some marks still from things like that. And so it's not worthwhile.
Does it have to be washed with bleach or just plain soap and water?
Bleach is in order, the idea of using bleach is in order to do something which we call pegima, that I'm making whatever was there undesirable. That's before I'm going to kosherize something, that it shouldn't have a different issue that when I kosherize something, maybe I'm really cooking it. So in order to make it that I'm not cooking it, if I'm cooking it, I was cooking something that was undesirable and therefore it was nullified. In terms of koshering, it doesn't necessarily help except for if it makes it poisonous or something like that. But by the time you touch it, it's not really going to make a difference on the handles. The main thing with the handle is to make sure it's clean. Nobody's eating off the handles. I didn't say anywhere's on the stove. No, on the stovetop, you want to cover your stovetop with aluminum foil, you could. Don't get carried away with it and start covering the dial thing behind, you know, the timer and the dials and all that type of stuff, because any parts that are made out of plastic or that are made out of, even nowadays with all the computer chips, they can much more easily melt. And it can cause a fire, chalila, you know, God forbid, and it definitely can ruin your oven. So you might not have to worry about it being kashal pesach, but you might not have it. So it's not, you know, don't get carried away with that. That's the countertop, sink. We talked about covering the handles on the stovetop and the oven. Now, in terms of kashering ovens, not covering. Good point. In terms of kashering ovens, so there is a halachic debate as to what method of kashering needs to be used for koshering ovens. Moshe Feinstein maintained that you need, along with many other poskim, that you need to do something called libun chomer, which is the highest extent of kosherizing something. The way that the Gemara describes seeing whether something reached a level of libun chomer is that it sparks, that it glows. It glows or that sparks come out of it. Okay? Which nowadays you're not going to see if pretty much from any metal, no matter how hot you get it, because it's galvanized and it's made in a way that it won't start to glow. Okay? The libun kal, which is a lower level of scorching, it needs to be that it's still very intense, that if you would put a piece of straw against it right after it was kosherized, it would burn up, it would be cinched right away, right? So nowadays, not too many people have straw around the house, but you might have tissues or paper or something like that, and that would be a way to, so to speak, test for it. Okay, but that would be for libun kal. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein maintained to kasher an oven, libun chomer needs to be used. So that it needs to get to a temperature that, in theory, once upon a time, regular metals at that type of temperature probably would glow or would spark. Now, when you blowtorch things, you'll see lots of sparks. But those sparks have nothing to do with the temperature of the blowtorch. It has to do with the fact there's a little bit of oil left behind. So there's a very small flame that flashes up and it looks like a spark. Okay? But that has nothing to do with reaching libun chomer. That will happen far, far, far before reaching libun kal. Rav Aaron Cutler and other poskim maintained that a libun kal was sufficient for kashering an oven. Now, the tremendous difference between what kind of kashering is necessary is how easy is it for us to kasher our home ovens. Okay? Industrial ovens, it's likely that you can get them to a level of libun chomer. Home ovens, not necessarily so. So yes, the American ovens with self-clean, and I'm being careful of saying American ovens with self-clean, doesn't mean not any Israeli ovens, but Israeli ovens that say self-clean aren't necessarily self-clean of the same nature. Okay, so American ovens with self-clean will reach libun chomer if you put it on self-clean. Okay, otherwise libun chomer would certainly have to be over 350 degrees Celsius, probably approximately. And you'd have to leave it like that till you're sure the whole oven, not just the air in the middle of the oven, but that the whole oven reached that type of temperature. So it would have to be left on for a tremendously long time, not tremendously long, go to a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour. Probably not be a bad idea to leave it even a little longer to make sure that everything really gets fully burnt out also. But that would accomplish a libun chomer. To turn the oven on to the highest temperature that it works at, which on a lot of ovens will be 250, that will work for a libun kal. So according to Rabbi Aaron, all ovens can be kashered. Now there's a caveat in this also, which is that most ovens in Israel, electric ovens in Israel, are, Israelis will refer to it as kombisteam, Americans will refer to it as convection, but they're convection ovens, or at least have a convection oven mode. Convection oven mode has a fan behind. The heat doesn't actually come directly from a heating element, rather a smaller heating element behind, and a fan that blows out the hot air. Okay, now it makes differences in your recipes because it's a much drier type of heat because it's being blown out, so your food is getting dried out, so to speak, as you're cooking it. So you'll have to, people make changes. That's part of the reason why sometimes people have to change their recipes, or their recipes just don't come out the same when they move from America to Israel or something like that. But when it comes to kashering, the question is, what do we do about the fan? In theory, the fan should be cleaned. It's hard to reach the fan, because especially in home ovens. In industrial convection ovens, you can take off the whole panel and you can clean the fan the same way you clean any other part. Most home ovens, either they won't come apart, or if they come apart, you're not really going to be able to put them back together. You certainly will lose your warranty on it if they know that you took it apart. Okay, and third of all, most people probably aren't so well versed in taking them apart. You know, they don't have the tools, and they would need special tools to do it, etc. So it's not really a viable option. That being the case, the best thing to do is to, so to speak, douse it with either something like bleach or oven cleaner, something which is definitely pogem. Okay? And before you kosher it, and about an hour before you kosher it, into the vent, and let it sit there, and it's wherever you're able to get it to. Let it sit there for a while. When you kosher it, when you kosher the oven, to kosher, if it has an option of not using the convection mode, kosher the oven without the convection mode, kosher the oven first with the it doesn't really make a difference which order, but to kosher the oven with and without the convection mode for about an hour. Okay? So that's how to kosher the oven. Again, it's a matter of contention whether libun kal can be used or whether you need libun chomer. If a person has the option to use libun chomer, of course it's best to, you know, accomplish the kosherizing of the oven according to all. If a person doesn't, there's what to rely upon. A person doesn't necessarily have to go out and buy a new oven or give up on using their oven over Pesach. They can use it with a libun kal. That's more or less the story with the ovens. If it's double wrapped, it would probably solve the problem. Again, you'd have to make sure that the oven was totally clean, and you'd have to try. You're gonna get a libun kal though, because a libun kal, if you only get a libun kal and you want to be machmer for a libun chomer, so that's a way around it. But you will get a libun kal, because however hot you cook year round is enough for your, will probably be enough for on the hottest. Yeah. So you have to leave it for a long enough time for it to dry. That's why you do it a few hours before you kosher. Long enough time to dry. Yeah. I recommend this every year. It's never made any problems. No, you can't wipe it off. It's in an event. But bleach won't be flammable. The oven cleaner could be flammable. But the bleach won't be flammable. But if you leave it to dry, it dries pretty quickly. It's a mist. It's not something that's going to take a long time. Yeah, and it will burn out when you turn it on. It will burn out. Spray. I did say douse, but I didn't really mean douse. I meant figuratively. To spray through the vent. You have to clean it well before, correct?
Yeah, and then you do the...
Right. Any oven needs to be cleaned well. In a self-cleaning oven, it cleans itself also. However, it should be cleaned ideally before you start the kashering process. So either you should self-clean twice, or you should clean it out beforehand with, you know, whether it's with oven cleaner or whatever it is, but clean it out well beforehand.
People could use instead of American ovens. What about European?
So, again, it depends on the exact oven, and you have to check what temperature it reaches while it's, you know, while it's using a self clean, etc. Yes.
And you said the temperature has to be enough for to burn a straw or a tissue or something. The Shabbos platter, if I put it on and leave it for a while, and then put a piece of paper, that's good enough.
It's not. You're not going to get to a Liebman Kal temperature on a Shabbos platter. But I'm about to talk about Shabbos platters because those are the next two common questions we get asked. Okay. Yes.
So you leave the racks in, and that's enough for the racks, or you have to blowtorch the racks?
No, if you left the rack in and it was enough for the oven, it's enough for the racks.
What about the grates on the stove?
The grates on the stove, that's a great question. No pun intended. So you could put it in the oven. It might, again, depending on how massive it is, it might get slightly discolored, it might get slightly bent out of shape. I'll tell you a trick that I don't know that I should be saying in public, but it's a great trick. If you have grates, it means you have a gas stovetop. If you take that little disc that sits on top of the gas stovetop off the gas will come out like a blowtorch. And then you hold the grates with like an oven mitt, and slowly you move it over that blowtorch, and you'll be able to kosher it slowly, and you can do it, you know, two or three times over to make sure you got every place or whatever it is, but you do it slowly, it will work. Now, if you have cabinets on top of your oven and you don't have, you shouldn't have cabinets on top if you don't have something to stop, if you don't have like a mindaf, I forgot what they call it in English, but a vent or whatever it is there, you shouldn't. But if you do, then I wouldn't recommend using it because that could be dangerous. A hood, that's the word, yes. But you could do it that way in theory. Also, alternatively, one could cover the grates with aluminum foil. It's apt to coming off over Yom Tov, and then you can do it again. It's not the end of the world, really. At the end of the day, it's probably not that big of an issue. So I wouldn't lose too much sleep over it. If a person is nervous about putting it into the oven, I put them in the oven, but mine are pretty massive. But you know, the little rubber things. Those rubber things, anyway. By the time you use your stovetop for 2 years, they're gone anyway. Okay, I don't know. In my house, they would be. Yes. So if it's reaching a libun chomer, it could. Although baking pans would probably get warped. By doing a libun chomer, so I wouldn't recommend it. And baking pans would need a libun chomer anyway, because if you bake on them directly, if you always cover it with aluminum foil, and I say aluminum foil because I'm not sure about the baking paper. If somebody always uses like two coats of baking paper, I think it would be fine. But one coat, I'm not so sure that it's okay. But with aluminum foil, that certainly would be fine if they always cover it with aluminum foil. Then you wouldn't need Libun Chomer, and you'd be able to kasher even with a Libun Kal. Back to the next popular questions, which are Shabbos urns and platas. Okay, Shabbos urn and platas, you know, it used to be even more frequently asked, and I think that, you know, as time goes on, people just say, okay, I'll buy another one. Okay, which that's not a bad idea. And if you have where to store it, if you can afford it, etc., sure, go ahead. But Pesach is expensive as it is, so some people, that's how they justify spending even a little bit more. They say, I'm not even going to notice it at this point, right? But since it's very expensive, it's not necessarily, you know, that so easy to tell everybody, just buy another one. Yes. A Shabbos urn can be koshered. Many, including the OU Poskim, are of the opinion that even though we don't usually kasher plastic when it comes to Pesach, for the spout of the urn, since it's not the main part of the urn, and because it's not really touching the chametz items, it's that we are concerned that maybe there's a negligible amount of chametz that comes in contact with it, either from the outside or while you're pouring something out or something that splashes back, yada, yada, yada. So that type of thing, because it's a negligible amount, not its main purpose, not its main use, the plastic spout could be kashered. There are those that in Israel, if you want to do that, it's still cheaper than buying a new urn. Okay, you can take it to all sorts of stores in Mea Sharim or Geula type of area. I'm sure there's other places also. I just know that the stores that do that. That you can buy a new spout for about 5 shekels and they'll put it on for you. Okay, so if you don't want to kasher the spout, you can just change the spout. To kasher the urn is really simple. You just boil water in it. But you fill it to the top, okay, and after it's finished boiling, you should not put on the top, fasten the top. Don't do it when you have kids around that might knock into it, or a clumsy spouse or something like that around either that might bump into it, okay? But when you know that it's safe in the kitchen and you put it well into the counter, etc., don't fasten the cap. You can leave the cap on so it should boil quickly, but you want to leave it in a way that you can take off the cap so that you can kind of, after it's boiled, move it a little bit, again, very carefully, that the water should just go a little bit over the top of the urn, okay? And then you accomplished kashering it. Again, it has to be clean beforehand. In order to clean it out beforehand, and the inside, you have buildup of sediment throughout the year. The best way to, you can use citric acid or lemon salt, as they call it when they sell it in the small spice containers, but it's just a fancy name for citric acid, okay? And or if you want a really cool trick that will make your house smell really good, why do they call it citric acid? It's not because it comes from lemons, but it's because they discovered it in citrus fruit. So citrus fruit have citric acid, and the more acidic of a citrus fruit, the more citric acid they have. So if you take lemons and you cut lemons in half and you boil them in your urn, it will also make your house smell great. And it will also accomplish the same thing. But you'll need a bunch of lemons to do it. It's not like one lemon will accomplish it. You can use vinegar, except for vinegar will make your house smell horrible. Sure. Synthetic vinegar, most vinegar that you buy, even if it says non-synthetic, it means that it's a biochemical process instead of being a chemical process. But it's acetic acid, and it's very much not a thing. And wine vinegars and things like that would be expensive, but that's also... Most of the vinegar you use during the year is kashrut Pesach. Platas. Platas, you can't kasher pretty much in any way, but you can use them. Okay? How do you use them? So in theory, covering it twice would be enough. What happens with aluminum foil, though, is it rips easily. Okay? So what I recommend doing is doing more than 2 layers of covering. Doing a good 3 or 4 layers, again, depending on how thick of the aluminum foil, etc. Now, what I am going to point out, though, is that it will diminish a little bit the heat of the plata. It's not a question of microns. It could be very thin. It has to do with layers, because halachically, we view the different layers as being separate. So it doesn't have anything to do with how thick it is. It needs to be, so you can even do different layers. You can do 1 layer of the thicker, you know, type of aluminum foil, which also you have to be really careful using the thick aluminum foil. That it's the number one injury Erev Pesach in Israel is people coming for stitches because they got cut using the thick aluminum foils. So you have to be super careful with that. Also, it's also they sell gloves for it in most hardware stores. You can go and buy a set of gloves to wear. It's not a bad idea. You know, that 10 shekel investment or whatever it is can save stitches on Erev Pesach. So that's really the story with the plata. Somebody doesn't want to buy a new plata, they can cover it. Again, it will diminish the heat slightly, so take that into account when you're warming up food, to put it on 5 minutes earlier, or to put a towel on top of it, or you know, something like that, in order to allow it to warm up a little bit more quickly. Shelves in the refrigerators just need to be cleaned. Again, I'm not starting up with anybody's minhagim of putting down layers and covering it, whether they do it with aluminum foil or contact paper or some sort of reshet, you know, some sort of mesh-like covering. I'm not starting up with anybody's menhagim, gesunte hate. You can do what you want. But halachically speaking, all they need is to be cleaned. So warming drawers, if they are reach a temperature above 40 Celsius, they should say summer's on it. But if it's warm, like really warm, like hottish warm, the way you would serve hot food, it probably does reach 40 Celsius. And then it should be, the hot water in your tap is more than 40 Celsius, most probably. When you take a shower, you're probably taking it at about 40 Celsius. It's a little bit above body temperature.
What about the pots?
And if you want something to feel warm, it needs to be a little bit warmer than you. So, it's a good question if it's kosherable at all. It's a good question. You know, the only place that I've really come across warming drawers is industrially, and there we can do libun kal certainly without any shilas, and sometimes even libun chomer. So we don't. I never had somebody ask me that question, and I have to think about it. And I'll tell you why I have to think about it. Walls of a kli, if you don't put the food directly into there, you're putting it in a pan into a warming drawer, which I imagine is what you're doing. Right? So it's not covered. There might be a little bit of steam, a little bit of residue, something like that. So the question is if that's a problem, especially when that's at a relatively lower temperature, would that be as much of an issue? What I would tend to say, again, you're catching me on the spot, you know, my Rebbe and the OU Posek, Rebbe Belsky, a blessed memory. So he one time used to give these Shilas and Tshuva sessions where you could ask any question you want in halacha and answer on the spot. And somebody asked him a question that caught him off guard. It was a question that some people maybe would see simple. They asked him about asking a guy to turn on the air conditioning on Shabbos. So he said that it's okay, not just heating, but also air conditioning. And somebody said, what about, can I ask him to change when the temperature was set at 75 degrees Fahrenheit? And I want to turn it down to 67 degrees Fahrenheit. Can I ask the guy in my same question, can you please turn it on to 67 degrees Fahrenheit? So at first he didn't understand what they were talking about. He says, what do you mean it's one dial? It's only one thing. He says, no, so they were explaining to him, no, it's buttons, you have to press it. So he didn't realize that nowadays, the way that most people have these little remotes that have lots of buttons on it, and you press to change the temperature, and it's a different button than the on, off button, etc. He was thinking about those dials that you have on the wall. Okay, so he said, I'm tempted to think that it's okay, but he said, I want to explain to you something. He says, when I answer these questions, it's not that I'm answering questions on the spot. All these questions, being a posik for so many years, I've thought about them so many times, and I've looked into them so many times, that when you're asking me them, I just, you know, I already know the answers to them. He says, now you're catching me on something that I never thought quite about this point. And, you know, it's hard for me to answer on the spot. I think what you probably could do to kosher it is they sell something which is like a steamer. What? Yeah, it's more than an iron. It's like a stick. It's for cleaning. They sell it for cleaning. They sell them around Pesach time in most hardware stores. I think if you would buy something like that, you probably would be able to kosher the warming drawer. We're turning on the warming drawer to its warmest temperature and then cleaning it with one of these steamers. I don't think so. Okay. I'll take one more question. And I want to try two more questions, and I just wanted to touch on products for 3 minutes. So.
So I just made aliyah recently. And
Mazel tov.
The process of making aliyah that minhag Yerushalayim that you have to, even if you kosher your counters, you still have to cover them. So
there's no minhag Yerushalayim like that. There might be people in Yerushalayim who have such a minhag, but I don't. I never saw it recorded anywhere. I live in Yerushalayim and I don't cover my counters. I'll be quite honest with you. I don't. What I do, and this is a chumrah, and I'm saying it like that it's a chumrah. I'm not suggesting this is what everybody should do. Next to the stovetop, where hot, very hot pots are put during the year and are apt to being put on Pesach, there I make like a little, you want to call it a plata or something like that, but I make a little tray out of the thick aluminum foil. You know, I double it or triple it over into a nice, perfect square tray, the exact size of the counter, for the area, you know, generous area of where I might put down, or whatever, my wife, whatever, might put down a boiling hot pot of soup or something that she just took off the stove or a frying pan or whatever it is, so that those areas where hot things go and whatever it is, in case I didn't kasher 100% per se, it's a chumrah. It's a far out chumrah. But to cover your counters, you don't need to. You want to? Gesundheit.
What about the seasonal?
After you kasher with boiling water from the urn on the marble counter, you don't have to cover it?
No. If you cover it, you don't have to kasher it. The seams are bottled to the rest of the counter, just like we said about the Caesar stone, and you can kasher them. So dishwashers, I'm going to suggest looking in the magazine. There is a guide to kashering kitchens. I just wanted to discuss certain things in greater depth. But the dishwashers, the OU's of the opinion that you cannot kasher for Pesach. That you cannot kasher. Okay. Again, I don't want to say all opinions, but that's the OU's opinion. Yeah, I'm just going to move on to the products. I know some people have to leave. I'm also going to have to leave soon, but I'll try to take a few questions after the products. Products are as follows. Okay, the OU tries to keep things simple always, and our OU symbols are always extremely simple. And sometimes we get questions and requests. You know, I see Mrs. Stewart, the office manager of Kashrus, is here for this year. So she can tell you about all the requests we get from different people. They want to write all sorts of shtiklach tayro, all sorts of explanations next to the ashkacha about what status of kashrus and how and this and that and how it's whatever. We don't allow that. And the reason why is we want to be super user friendly and keep it as simple as possible. People shouldn't get confused. You buy something, it has to be ready to use. We don't certify things that still need to be checked for bugs. We don't certify things that still need to be kashered. We don't certify things like that because we want it to be simple and easy and to avoid having mistakes happening. Okay? In Israel, they're a little bit less sensitive to that. Okay? So, in America, we'll put out in the guide, again, to make it easier for you, products that might be kasher l'Pesach, even though it doesn't say kasher l'Pesach, but those are generally products that don't need to be kasher l'Pesach. Like olive oil. That olive oil, as long as it's virgin olive oil, 100% virgin olive oil, doesn't need to be kasher l'Pesach. Period. Not even if it wasn't OU, doesn't need to be kasher l'Pesach. And if it came from any other place in the world other than Israel, it wouldn't need to have any kosher symbol on it. 100% virgin olive oil anywhere in the world is what we refer to as a group one. It doesn't need kosher certification. So too salt. So too white sugar. Okay, all sorts of different products like that. And we have that in the list in the guide. Okay, but products, it will say kosher l'Pesach, and we require, doesn't mean that there's never any mistakes that happen, that there's a company that labeled something mistakenly and it got caught a little too late or whatever it is. But we require anything that's kosher l'Pesach to be labeled OUP. Israeli ashkachas don't work that way. If it says anywhere on the package, okay, kosher l'Pesach or kosher for Passover or something like that, inkjetted, a sticker, a stamp, anything like that, somewhere's on the package, and next to the Israeli ashkacha, it doesn't say liyamot hashanam bilvad, for year-round use only, or lo kolel Pesach, not for Pesach. It means that Israeli ashkacha takes responsibility also for the Pesach stamp that was stamped on it. Okay? So that's tip number one. Tip number two, okay? Right, so that ashkacha does not certify for Pesach, whereas whoever's inkjetted on does. Okay, but if I have a product, I bought a product. I'll give you an example. You buy a product that has Eda Charedis on it. Okay, Bedat Eda Charedit on it. One of the bigger ashkachos in Israel, right? I think probably everybody here is somewhat familiar with it. You buy a product that has it on. Now it has inkjetted on the top. Kasher l'Pesach, Tavshin Ayin Bet. Okay? Now, it doesn't say next to the symbol of the Eda Charedit, Limot HaShana Bevar, or Lo Kolel Pesach. It means that the Eda Charedit is taking responsibility also for Pesach. Okay? If, however, it would be inkjetted on the top, Kasher l'Pesach, and now you have the Eda Charedit, and Rabbanut, I don't know, Afula, whatever it is, right? So, by the Eda Charedit, it says Lo Kolel Pesach, The Rabbanut Afula doesn't say anything like that, and it's ingeted on top, kasher lePesach. Only the Rabbanut takes responsibility for it for Pesach. Okay? Now, there's the where it starts getting more complicated is for Ashkenazim, the whole idea of kitniot. Okay? And then they come up with code words for kitniot. So kitniot, they have to say on it that it's lochle kitniot bavad. So that makes it a little simpler. It still means you have to check out for it just because it was in your super kosher supermarket in the Pesach section doesn't necessarily mean that it's okay for you. Okay, but that's fine. What gets more complicated is when they write lochlei letzitin or liftit, lochlei liftit, which is really the Hebrew, proper Hebrew word for letzitin, for lecithin. Okay, and what they're trying to get around is like this. They say, you know, kitnios, most Ashkenazim won't, you know, they're not going to eat corn on the cob and they're not going to eat cornbread. Okay, fine, granted, they're not going to eat rice and they're not going to eat rice crackers or rice noodles. But maybe, you know, things that aren't directly kitnios, they came out of kitnios or something like that. And there were various rabbis that wanted to maintain like that at various points in time. Maybe some of them will eat things like that. Oyu Poskim do not accept that. And if it's made from kitnios, it's kitnios. But in order to get around that, products that are manufactured from kitnios, they'll write in these types of terms in order that it's not lochle kitniot, it's not corn flour. It's just something that kind of came out of the corn, you know, was extracted from the corn or something like that. Now, with liftit in particular, when they write the word liftit, usually it means it's coming from canola oil, which is rapeseed, which also brings us to the question of canola oil. Okay, that's another common question we get asked before Pesach. So, canola oil, the Oyu Poskim maintain that it's a problem for a very simple reason. It comes from something called rapeseed. Sometimes you'll see on it, it will say rapeseed oil. Rapeseed is part of the mustard family. So it's a type of mustard which is very bitter and it's not usually used to eat, you know, by human consumption. But the way they view it is that since one of the original plants that was part of kitnios was mustard, and it's part of the mustard family, and it looks like mustard. If you see a picture on some of the canola oils, they even have pictures of the rapeseed on it to make it look more natural. Okay, don't be fooled. It still goes through a lot of processes. It looks like a mustard. It looks like wild mustard. So because of that, I say, you know, there's a concept of lo plug that we don't start to split hairs. And it's part of the mustard family. Mustard's kitnios. It's also kitnios. So I think we covered now most of the issues with Pesach. If it says lo chle liftit, it usually means that it's made with canola oil. If you don't eat canola oil, you don't want to buy that product. Lecithin just means, could be soy lecithin and canola lecithin, but still some people will say that lecithin, because it's derived from the oil, it's a derivative of a derivative, so they say it's enough removed from the actual kitnios and they're not going to makbid on it. That's why they write it and that's why they phrase it in such a way. Nonetheless, many people, and including the OU Poskim, maintain that Ashkenazim shouldn't consume such products on Pesach. All the best. We do have a hotline. I think the number's in all the publications that we put out here. And Rabbi Friedman, who probably would have given this class today instead of me, will be happy to answer all the questions on the hotline. He does an excellent job doing it.